if I'm high, I won't think about it, but I hate being high. I got to the point where I hated it so much, but I couldn't stop doing it. I'd buy a gram and just stick the straw in the bag and just start snorting because I wanted to get rid of it. Because once it was gone, then it was gone.
Right.
But then I'd just go buy more. I couldn't stop doing it. So it was that cycle of just being miserable. Now, 23 years sober, it's been like this. It hasn't been a smooth ride. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it has for anyone. If it hasn't, God bless them, man. I don't mean by relapse, but I mean by mental. 14 years sober, I'm curled up in a fetal position on the sofa going, what is my life? What's my purpose? Oh my God, I can't seem to get ahead. It had nothing to do with sobriety. It just had to do with up here.
Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of the Easy Conversations podcast, a podcast about having easy conversations. I'm your host, Furkan Dandia. In this week's episode, I sit down with Chip White, who is the host of the podcast Relatively Famous, and we explore identity, addiction, recovery, and what it truly means to find your own path. Chip shares his journey of growing up as the brother of Vanna White, navigating the pressures of comparison, ego, and eventually falling into addiction. What follows is a deeply honest conversation about hitting rock bottom, surrender, and rebuilding a life grounded in purpose. We explore what it means to live in the shadow of someone else's success, the role of ego, entitlement, and comparison, addiction, shame, and the cycle of self-destruction, the moment of surrender that led to Chip's 23 years of sobriety, why recovery is not just about substances, but about identity and meaning, and the importance of accountability, faith, and daily practice. Our conversation is not just about recovery, it's about self-awareness, humility, and learning to build a life that is truly your own. Chip White is a film and television producer with over 30 years of experience, having worked with companies like Sony, MTV, and Discovery. He is the host of Relatively Famous and a speaker on storytelling, recovery, and reinventing life after 65. Please check out all the ways you can find Chip's work. And before we jump into the episode, a quick reminder that the content of this podcast episode is just for educational, informational purposes. It has no affiliation to my therapeutic practice. If you are seeking therapy, please reach out to a licensed professional. Now let's just jump into the episode. Hey, good morning, Chip. Welcome to Easy Conversations. Thank you for joining me this morning. I'm really excited about our conversation. We had an opportunity to connect at PodFest about a month ago. And yeah, we talked about a little bit about recovery and we talked about your podcast. So I'm sure we'll get into all of that. But just to give the listeners a little bit more, I would like to give you an opportunity to share who you are and what's brought you here today.
Sure. Thanks for having me this morning. I appreciate it. And I'm looking forward to our conversation. I love conversations. Love to chat. Yeah. I'm Chip White. I grew up in North Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. My sister is Vanna White of Wheel of Fortune, hence my podcast, Relatively Famous, where I interview relatives of famous people.
Yeah.
And we were at PodFest 2026. I had a speaking thing. What was it? Launch, expectations and perseverance in your first year of podcasting. And I think you spoke there too. I'm not sure.
Yes.
I can't remember.
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
So we started chatting there. I was like, yeah, give me a holler. If I'm available, I'd love to be on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. And what I found fascinating, because I spoke to Phil as well, and he explained the premise of the show, but Relatively Famous and some of the stories. And I guess maybe a good point to start the premise of your show, being in the shadow of a famous relative and how you need to navigate that. How has that been for you, knowing your sister has been a national, if not international, celebrity for so many years? When you think about the show itself, you can make the case it wouldn't exist without her, right?
It was a daytime show for many years with Chuck Woolery and Susan Stafford. Chuck left, Pat came on. I think he was here a year. Then Susan Stafford, she wanted to pursue other avenues. Van ended up getting the job. Again, it was just a daytime game show for a year. King World came in, bought syndication rights. And within 2 years of that, man, it just exploded. And she did. She's an American icon. She is known internationally, not as much. One time she did go to Iceland with her daughter for a graduation present. She goes, we had a tour guide. She goes, and of all the tour guides in all the places, this guy knew who I was. So it's standing, like you said, the podcast is, how do you make your own sunshine when you stand in the shadow of famous person's name. Some shadows are bigger than others. Some relatives are further down the line. When I interview a parent, it's different than a sibling or a cousin or something like that, because a parent guides that child into that realm that made them famous, whether it's sports, music, television, film. Brother, dude, I've got no influence on her career. She made it before I did. I wasn't there as a manager, very few that happens, but she has been extremely generous and extremely loving the whole time. She's always been protective. And I think that in the beginning, there was definitely, it was harder standing in the shadow. All of a sudden she's everywhere. She's huge. And it's like, my ego is like, where's mine? But what was I doing to deserve where's mine? Nothing. I was just being like, hey, where's mine? I'm here. Don't you know who I am? Kind of thing. And definitely not in a physical and mental best state of mind, because it was definitely when she started my, I was pretty deep in that drug use at the time. And it was all ego. You know who I am and where's mine? It was probably more harmful to her career. I probably embarrassed her more than she'll ever admit at certain times.
Yeah. Yeah. And are you able to speak to that a bit more? And how do you contend with that? Obviously, with the benefit of time, we can look back on some past choices we've made. And in my clinical work, I often am guiding people through the shame, right? But that shame can be so profound and it can trap us. And that's where you see people often will then resort to addiction as a form of escape. But are you able to speak to it in your own life, how it showed up?
My experience was, I didn't start doing drugs to hide anything. It was late 70s. It was all fun at the time. We were having fun. It wasn't that. It was late 70s. It was the disco era. Coke was the thing. It was just a big blast. Now, maybe subconsciously there were things that might have been trying to hide. I don't know. It's as I got deeper into it, it definitely was more shame, because you're hiding the things that you do when you're high. Your behavior is bad. Your sexual deviance is off the chart. You're unemployable. You're a horrible father. You're a horrible son. You're a horrible brother. All those things happen the deeper you get into it. So that part of the shame, yeah, probably was a cycle. If I'm high, I won't think about it, but I hate being high. I got to the point where I hated it so much, but I couldn't stop doing it. I'd buy a gram and just stick the straw in the bag and just start snorting, because I wanted to get rid of it. Because once it was gone, then it was gone.
Right.
But then I'd just go buy more. I couldn't stop doing it. So it was that cycle of just being miserable. Now, 23 years sober, it's been like this. It hasn't been a smooth ride. And I don't think it has for anyone. If it hasn't, God bless them, man. I don't mean by relapse, but I mean by mental. 14 years sober, I'm curled up in a fetal position on the sofa going, what is my life? What's my purpose? Oh my God, I can't seem to get ahead. It had nothing to do with sobriety. It just had to do with up here.
Yeah. Yeah. And a lot of people in the recovery world talk about rock bottoms, right? And everyone's version of it is different for obvious reasons. But what was the crossroad for you where you chose sobriety and have stayed with it for the duration of time you have? If you're able to share a little bit of that. Yeah.
Yeah. Several years before I got sober, in my mind, it was just the coke. It wasn't the drinking. It wasn't a little, I was never a big pot smoker. So it wasn't, I did, but it wasn't like my thing. The weed, it wasn't a pill every now and then. Just at the end, man, it was just heavy coke and alcohol, right? Coke and alcohol to come down. And probably a couple of years prior, I knew I had a problem, and I said, I've got this, I'm going to stop. And I quit for 9 months. Mm. And as the book says, one sunny day, I said to my buddy, let's get a gram. Mm. And that started the last run. And at that point, man, I became unemployable. I would lock myself in the room to stay away from the family. It was just, I had a house. We had cars. I wasn't selling all my watches. It wasn't like I was selling everything. I just was spending our money and isolating. And just, I would stare at the clock radio. Don't you remember those things? And I'd look at it and go, I know there's a camera in there. My wife's spying on me. And I would just stare at it, but I couldn't take it. I wouldn't take it apart because I knew I couldn't get it back together. And I was like, explain, why'd you take the clock radio apart? I was high as a kite. So that was kind of the rock bottom. And it was just, I just couldn't stop. It's on September 11th of 2002, the year after 9/11. Mm-hmm. That was a good excuse. I'm getting high and whatever. My dad's in town. My son's like, he's two and a half, almost three. I just turned 42. My dad was out visiting all these things. And on the 12th, I woke up. My wife said, I'm done. You're high as a kite. You've been lying. You've been using, taking our kid. I'm done. I don't care if you kill yourself. We'll sell the house. I'm just done. Mm. And that was the catalyst to change me. I went, started going to meetings. I didn't get sober on the 12th. I quit doing drugs, but I didn't get sober till October 2nd or 3rd. Because I mean, it was just the coke. I started going to CA meetings. I had to quit doing the coke. And I asked this guy to sponsor me on October 2nd. I said, hey, Sean, will you sponsor me? But I'm going to be honest with you, dude. I'm going to have a glass of wine with my steak or a cocktail. He goes, it's not how it works, man. CA is all mind altering substances. So that night I went and had a couple glasses of wine, and next one I woke up and go, you know, God, I give. I give up. I know what's going to happen if I do it my way. I don't know what happened if I do it theirs. There was a shift. It wasn't a bright light. It wasn't like singing angels. There was just a shift.
Yeah.
And for 23 years, I haven't had the need. I don't want to say I haven't had the desire, man. You dream about getting high. I had dreams, man, where I've taken a big drink of a thing, or I've snorted some coke, and I woke up, man, in a panic going, oh my God, no, I'm not giving up my sobriety. I went, oh dude, it's just a cream, really high.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting you mentioned, and I agree with you. It doesn't have to be some bright white light or angels, but the shift, what I'm hearing from your story is that surrender and the acceptance that I'm powerless. And I think that's where a lot of people, I've experienced that too, when I've been able to just in certain cases turn it over to my higher power that I can't do this on my own. I've tried, and I don't know what it is, if it's a mental shift or if there's truly something powerful going on behind the scenes, that it's helped and it's just allowed me to just give into it and recognize that, I can't white knuckle my way through some of these things.
Yeah. And it's hard. It's hard in a way because it works so easy with sobriety. Like God's got this, whatever. And it's not an issue for me. It's not like I don't crave it. I don't think about it. It's not something, because I know that God did the shift and he's got it. But man, there's other things I just can't. It's, man, I'm struggling with this. Turn it over. I'm trying, but I'm not going complete. Yes. I haven't done that completely. Like, you know what? I'm done, man. I give up. Just my sponsor at the time when I got sober, he said, you know what it is when to surrender? I'm like, to give up. He goes, no, man, it's to join the winning side. You're tired of getting your ass kicked.
Yes.
Give up and join the winning side. I was like, that makes sense. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I appreciate the one-liners you hear from some of the people that have been veterans in the recovery community. They always have these catchy one-liners that just hit you, right? In the right moment. And we all internalize them differently. One of the things because we did touch on PodFest, I think for me was powerful. And I know you attended the recovery meeting on the Saturday. I attended the one, or I think you attended the one on the Friday and I attended the one on Thursday. So we weren't at the same meeting, but for me being there was a big trigger for many reasons. One was in my past life and previous career, when I'd go to conferences like this, that was when I would
feel like I had given myself the permission to act out. Being away from home, being in another city, nobody knows me. It was like the perfect excuse. And I could feel that tension arise in me. I started my day with my morning routine. I did my prayers. And I just randomly stumbled into this meeting. And it just, being able to sit there and share with other people just allowed me to ground myself. And I just, that tension I was feeling all morning was gone. I think part of it was also because I was speaking that morning too. And as soon as I finished my talk, I just felt this relief, but then also wanted to seek out more of a relief. So that was my experience, but I was super grateful that they had something like that, because in my experience in other conferences, they don't necessarily think about these things, and people could be struggling in silence or isolation. For me, and that was the message I heard in my meeting, was how other people were feeling triggered, whether it was alcohol or other things for them.
Yeah, same thing. I heard a lot of people talking about how they were struggling. And like, I think like any of us that were in their conferences, for me, were like, dude, I've got an expense account. I'm in New Orleans. I'm wherever. Let's rock and roll till the break of dawn. And, and it was all acceptable back then when I was doing that conference. Business conferences have changed.
Yes.
But back then, man, we were talking the 80s and 90s when it was just wide open. But I don't struggle with them, those feelings so much now. And again, it's just like, I know I can't drink. It doesn't matter where I am. It doesn't matter how many people are drinking. I drove people around, like a big group of us went to karaoke and stuff. I'm like, I'll be your driver. It's your car, but I'll drive you guys drink. I don't care. I think that the meeting for me there was, it was just a moment to step back and hear other people's struggles. Mind myself again. Like, yeah, you know what? You can be here. It's okay. I feel for people that are really struggling when they're there. You can't talk them into feeling great. They got to find that way themselves. But
yeah,
I'm great. And it was a reminder to be grateful. Dude, I can just enjoy this conference. I'm glad the meeting's here, but if it wasn't, I still was going to have a great time. I still was going to get the things out of love I needed. Because I went last year, and I don't know if they had one.
Yeah, I don't think they did.
Or if I just didn't see it. A lot of times, I think if I'd have had a car, I probably would looked up and gone off site. But being in Orlando, things are pretty far. So I don't want to get an Uber and spend 30 minutes driving mine. How important is your sobriety? Anyway, but I think had I been struggling with it, that would have been like, just get the Uber, man. It's not, your life depends on it. But I'm at a point in my sobriety where it's like, you know what? I can get through this. This isn't, again, I always say, man, when Chip White got sober and quit doing drugs, not one drug dealer stopped selling drugs. Not one liquor store closed.
Yeah.
It's my problem. It's not the world's.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So what's allowed you, what are the things that you practice on a day-to-day basis to hold yourself accountable and manage your recovery? What's helped you over the last 23 years?
It's a lot of this again.
Yep.
There are, like when I lived in, we moved to Charlotte when I was 3 years sober, and at about 4 years sober, man, I really just said, you know what? I got to get back in, dive in. So I dove in really deep, found my Wednesday meeting was my meeting. I started getting sponsees. I would work with them before the meeting. I'd work with another group after the meeting. So Wednesday was like this solid day of 6 p.m. to 11 p.m. of recovery. And when I traveled, I would always look for somewhere. Afterwards, we moved to Texas. I'm not as involved. I'm not doing as many meetings as I would like. We bounce between towns and stuff, and I travel. These are all excuses, but I'm grounded enough. And I call my old sponsor in South Carolina. We talk a lot. I try to morning meditate. I'm not doing it perfectly, dude. Some of my behavior is not the guru AA thing. But you know what? I'm just not getting loaded, man. Does that mean I shouldn't behave the way I do sometimes? Absolutely. Do I catch myself and try to render it? Yes. But Dude, I'm still full of anxiety a lot of times. I don't practice the thing I preach about. You know what? Just what does it matter? Lower your expectations sometimes. But man, sometimes I'm eating up inside, man. And some of that comes from social media. You know, just throwing things at you to divide you and irritate you that are just happening in this little spot. Mm. But we've now made them think that they affect us. Where, look what's going on in Minnesota. Mm. It does not affect my life. I'm 2,000 miles away trying to work, keep houses up. So, it might suck or it might be right. But I have to step back and say, dude, that does not affect your life. Don't sit there and dwell on it so hard and let it ruin your day because you can't do anything about it and it's not affecting your day-to-day moment. Does that make sense?
Right. Yeah, I think so. And I appreciate you bringing that up because there are different ways of looking at it. And I've heard people look at it different ways too. But to your point, yes, before social media or the way media has gone in general, we wouldn't necessarily hear about these things and it wouldn't be in our face all the time. So to your point, it would be out of sight, out of mind. And is it truly affecting you? Of course, you can have an opinion about it. You can feel a certain way about it. But because of the way the algorithms are designed, it's constantly feeding you that information just to, at the end of the day, it's to elicit an emotional response. Right. And the more emotional we get, the more we respond and react to these things. Now, the flip side of it is people will say, you don't have to buy into the divisiveness. If you don't give it energy, then it doesn't thrive. But to me, I can agree with that to a certain point. But at the end of the day, you still have to acknowledge it and not be naive that these things are existing in society today and people are buying into it. And it's not that you say, oh, I'm either on the left or the right. You have to be able to say what is wrong, irrespective of which side you fall on. And I think a lot of times people get stuck in that picking a side thing rather than looking for the truth. So I don't know what your thoughts are around that, just because it's come up in our conversation. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of how to put it. I think that you can have feelings and opinions on it. I think in conversation like this, you might, if we were completely opposite thoughts on this,
yes.
And I don't know if we are or we're not, I don't know. We might be able to convince someone to rethink the opinion, right? But on social media, you can blast all you want and you're probably not going to change my mind.
Yes.
As a matter of fact, like the book says, step on my toes and what am I going to do? I'm going to retaliate. And that's an emotional response. I think what I'm trying to say is I try to take that emotional out of it and go, okay, give me the facts. There's three sides to every story, right? Your
Correct.
Side, my side, and then there's the truth somewhere in the
yes.
middle.
Yes.
Because you and I could sit there and be a podcast and I could say, done. You go, no, it wasn't that at all. We're at the same place, same time. You're seeing a different perspective than I'm seeing. The fact is we're both right in that perspective at that moment. In our world. Now, if someone ran into PodFest and robbed us at gunpoint and left, you might say the dude was 6'2" and he had dark hair. And in my mind, I might have seen someone 5'9" with sandy blonde hair because we're in the moment, we're seeing something different. Mm-hmm. But the fact was it happened. You see the same thing I saw. That makes sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And when I'm working with couples, I often remind them of something similar, that we're different people with different experiences that shape our worldviews. So we often internalize things too. And a lot of the times that's where I see couples get hung up, is they'll focus on an argument and they'll be arguing about how both interpreted the situation differently, rather than, to your point, taking a step back and be like, okay, neither one of us is wrong here. And when we try to prove the other person wrong, we both end up losing, right? And that's what I see in social media. If people are trying to get the upper hand, they're not engaging in a respectful, healthy dialogue where both people can walk away feeling like they've gained something. It's just a matter of how can I put the other person down and prove a point, which I think becomes problematic. What I appreciate about at least long form content like podcasts in general is you can have a deeper exploration, right? If you were to present a view, I can inquire more if I truly want to learn. And then right. It's not about a short comment on a social media platform and then you shut down the communication, right? So that's been my experience. But coming back to the recovery side, I have to be very careful, and I'm really grateful for one of the clinical directors I work with. I've learned so much from him where he knows where to draw the line and step away, because in my early years, if I can say that right now in recovery, I often don't know where to draw the line, and it can pull me into the away from what I need to do for myself and maintain my health. So, yeah.
Yeah. The fire that I had in those years in Charlotte isn't as bright in Texas as it was there. I mean,
yeah,
there's a lot more life at me at the moment, a different mm-hmm. kind of life. Mm-hmm. We were back then, we were raising our son. I was working at speed. I mean, there was all these different things. They mm-hmm. changed, and some affected mentally harder than others. Here it's the drinking, the alcohol. I'm not worried about going out and getting loaded. I'm not worried about mm-hmm. the drug dealer walking up me. I'm worried about the plumber coming and fixing the bathroom. I'm worried about trying to get a mm-hmm. sales at Nelco and ABA. Mm-hmm. I'm worried about trying to get guests at the podcast. I'm worried about paying the damn property taxes on places mm-hmm. that's through the roof. So it's a different kind of, my sobriety tends to not quite take the lead, which is crazy because I wrote a script mm-hmm. called Above All Else. Means my sobriety is above all else. It's my sobriety. Mm-hmm. Then there's God. Mm-hmm. Oh no, there's God, then sobriety. I'm like, look, without sobriety, I wouldn't have God for me. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't yeah. have this relationship with God. So the script is, if I put my sobriety above everything, then everything below it's going to be great, or at least fall into place. Mm-hmm. You know, God, family, If I put those things above my sobriety, then those are eventually going to go away.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm not there to argue something about you. If God is your number one or your sobriety is number one, they're really equal. But I know that without either one, I'm not going to have either one.
Yeah, I really appreciate that perspective. And if we were to expand on it, if you're, say, using, you're not in a place to connect to God. Maybe you can, right? You can seek him out and have prayers and all of that. But I agree with you. I think you need to be at a certain level mentally to truly appreciate that relationship with God. So I do like that perspective because, yes, you have to show up a certain way. And in my faith, too, we believe in that self-mastery, which you can perhaps draw parallels to when it comes to sobriety, right? If you're having mastered yourself, it's hard to really have a connection with God.
Yeah, and there are people that can do drugs and they can drink and they're good. Like, I've had friends over my life. It's a weekend, do some blow, come Monday, dude, they're good. They're good for another month, they're good for a year. Not my case.
Yes.
And I think that's where the people that, normies or whatever, they can still get a relationship with God because it's the drugs and alcohol really aren't ruling their life. Where for me, it was those things were ruling above God. Like, how many foxes, oh God, just please don't let me use today. Or go to church. Like, I'd go to church to try to get this relationship. But as you were saying earlier, shame. In my mind, I was so full of shame that how could God love me when he sees this behavior? I'm going to leave church and I'm going to go buy a gram. How could God love me when I'm in that point? It took going through the program of 12 steps to go, oh, you know what? God still loves me. I looked at my son at the point. It's like, dude, he's 3. He's frustrating. He's this, he's that. But there's nothing he's doing. There's nothing that he's going to do that will make me not love him. I may be disappointed. I may get angry. I may get frustrated. But there's nothing he's ever going to do that's not going to make me love him as my son. And in recovery, they go, you're a child of God. I went, ooh, okay. So if God's my father, then he may be disappointed. He may be frustrated. He may be angry at me, but he still loves me.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, I can deal with that. That opens that door for me to, okay, let's build this relationship.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it all comes down to how we find that door. And sometimes we're not, we tell ourselves that the door isn't there, or we don't want to look for it, or or it's closed. And what I've learned, it's always open. We just need to step through.
Right.
And just accept it. Yeah. Yeah. That's beautiful. Coming back to your being in that shadow of your sister, you were touching on asking, where's mine? And sometimes that can bring up envy too, right? And knowing that, oh, maybe there is envy can also bring up shame, because we don't want to admit those faults that we all have inherently as humans. And we have that propensity for these things. So are you able to talk about what were the feelings that you were having watching your sister take off and then your own addiction there being present? How were you navigating all of that, and how has it shaped your life now?
I know that, like, when I first moved to LA in the early 80s, she hadn't gotten real yet. We were a manager at the time, and I was 20 something doing a little bit of work, but and I wasn't necessarily in her shadow then, because we were, she was still trying to make it. I was just, I was like floating in the world, trying to figure what the heck I'm, where I'm supposed to be, what I'm supposed to do. Let's have a good time. It's all about, let's have a good time. She gets wheel. I move back to South Carolina. She's taking off. Things are going. John gets killed. So I move back out to work for her. And at that, by then I'd really start doing a pretty good bit of drugs. And we had some neighbors across the street that just every night we were just blowing through piles of coke. And my sister should have fired me. She said, I'm sending you back home because you're useless. She loved me and I was working for her. And eventually I went to work for other, for King World. But again, I'm still knee deep in it. And hell, they should have fired me, but they wouldn't, because I'm Vanna's brother and them millions of dollars off a wheel. So any of that that I felt, whereas mine was undeserved in reality. I was too busy getting high at work. I was too busy being just, I wasn't the human being that deserved any of what should have, what I was trying to grasp. Does that make sense? And even in sobriety, look, I got sober and I was like, woo, I'm sober, I'm clean, yay. Where's the world? And it was, they're not sure we believe you yet. Right. My sister's, that's good. Yeah. We started, I moved to North Carolina, started making short films with a guy. And people go, oh, did Vanna pay for that? I'm like, no, she didn't. As a matter of fact, until we were done with the first one and she actually saw that we made a really good short film and it was getting recognition. And she's like, okay, you know what? I'll help you get started with the next one. I'm paying for it, but here's a little seed money. And then the next year goes, okay, you guys, here's a little seed money. It was never like, here's a check, just go make the movie, like people thought. I think I talk about this a lot of my guests is, just because my sister's wealthy, I'm not. She's generous. Don't get me wrong. But it's not, oh, Chip, here's $1 million check. No, I'm not wealthy because of her. And I think in the beginning, when it really hit, that's the where's mine. And so you just made that, write me a check. Why should I? You're just my drugged up brother. It probably happens to a lot of other people in that shadow, whether there's children or siblings or to the person. You just wrote a football player's, oh, you just got a $20 million contract. It's all over the news. Give me $500,000. You're my cousin. Why am I going to give you $500,000? Right.
Yeah.
You know, but I think people like, they think that it's theirs, like they deserve it. They earned it. It's not the case. It took a long time for me to build that relationship with my sister. Like, she doesn't give us money for the podcast. She helps promote it, but it's not her thing anymore. She's been generous through the years and she is still, but it's not, whatever you want, Chip, I'm going to pay for it. And that's great, because I have to prove that I could do something.
Yeah.
Makes here.
Yeah. And I think ultimately, again, bringing it back to the recovery side of things, you also don't want to enable someone's behavior. And what I'm hearing it perhaps early on, maybe she did to a certain extent by not firing you sooner. But then obviously we learn from our own experiences. Yeah. And now to me, it sounds like it's a very healthy relationship where there's support, but there's not enabling. And we all have to chart our own paths. And it's interesting you touched on it, because I've talked to other people who have family members that have taken off. And sometimes there is that, right, where I was part of you, especially as parents or siblings. I was part of this, right? I was there. I was supporting you. Where's my piece of this? And what have you noticed in your conversations? Like, how do people navigate that? Because you're talking to the family member, the relatively famous, person.
I think so, it's been different for some. A lot have had the same experience I have. I think others have, they're still trying to, because a lot of people try to follow their siblings' footsteps, right? Or their, again, parents are usually different. Sometimes I think most of the parents I've talked to, their child has been very supportive, as much financially as they can or there. Now, some may have bad relationships. I don't try to delve into the negative. I'm not looking for dirt on them.
Yeah,
I'm really trying to find out, hey, what's your life like? You know, what do you do? So I think, but some have had that moment of, and they, we've talked about it, like, beginning, when it really, when someone really takes off, are they really, again, well, I'll use sports because sports tend to have the biggest contracts, right?
Right.
Whole family and friends, it's gimme, gimme, gimme. I'm going to be your manager. I'm going to be your shoe boy, whatever. Mm-hmm. So that person tends to want to give. Look, Anna is very smart with her money. She's very, she's had a good manager. She's had good accountant. She knows, she's not someone who just goes, oh, okay, county, here's my check. Okay, let me know when I'm out of money. She, so she hasn't been just freewheeling, but there's times like, hey, you know what? I'm in a pinch. No problem. And she'll help me. She has helped me. But it's, but it also hasn't been like every week, okay, here's $1,000, and that's okay. I don't expect that.
Right.
30 years ago, when I was in my, let me rephrase that, 40 years ago when I was in my 20s. I'm older now. My ego had been like, come on, where's mine? And where's my job? Where's my movie? Don't you guys know I'm Vanna White's brother?
Yeah.
Here, I've got this great idea for a movie. Did you have a script? No. Do you have an actor? No. Do you have, no. But give me $25 million and I'll make it happen. What do you mean you're not going to give me $25 million? Vanna's brother. Nothing to offer.
Yeah, that sense of entitlement, right, I think can be debilitating for people. And unfortunately, many people don't realize that. But that, right, like you said, the friends and the family members will come out all of a sudden and they want to be around that person or be a part of it. And to your point, if the individual themselves is not disciplined and mindful of how their money is being spent and how they're giving it away, that can cause them issues later on. And you see that a lot with child actors or athletes who get big contracts in their teens or early 20s, and all of a sudden they've got millions of dollars flowing in and they don't even know how to save it. They have no financial literacy. And there's, unfortunately, the reality is there's a lot of predators around waiting, right, to just get a piece of it. So you hear all these stories. Unfortunately, that does happen.
Yeah, she's been lucky. And definitely we've had family members ask and friends. She goes, so-and-so asked me for something. She goes, I just feel bad saying no, but I think it goes back to the enabling, right? I can't enable them to learn how to get out of the mess they got themselves in. Because trust me, she enabled me enough to where I was not getting out of my mess.
Because
again, she is generous and it's tough. I sometimes forget how you think, oh my God, that's Vanna White. That's Clint Eastwood. That's Kevin Costner. Their life is amazing. That's Taylor Sheridan. Everything they touch turns to gold. You forget, you know what? There's a big price. Her price has gotten down. She can go public and do whatever she wants and it's no big deal. There was a time when that price was very high, man. She, everywhere she went, it was tabloids and this and that. And it was constant press, whether good or bad. So there's that price, man, that you have to look at. Billie Eilish right now, man, she made one statement
and
she's getting hounded. She's got the most, she's worth millions and she's got amazing properties, but one statement and now her world has changed.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's, I can have compassion. It can be a lonely place, right? You can feel lonely at times, especially if you're being, if you're having boundaries and you're not enabling others and you have to say no. And then the other prices you're talking about with having to always be cognizant of, okay, that public aspect and how much do you get out? How much do you protect yourself? That, you put all of that together, it is a lonely place. And often people just focus on the limelight and the benefits that come with being in that position, but they don't necessarily factor in all the other things that, and the cost that the individual incurs. And we don't necessarily even with appreciate family, that. Yeah.
Sometimes you get to a point where you can't go to a family reunion. I'm not saying this is Vanna's case. I'm making a hypothetical here. It's because every family member wants to be there. They're there for a reason. They just want to have a picture. It's this. And it's okay because you want to feel close to the fame, right? I've been on that line where I've stepped on the fame. I've been outside the wall. It, it bounces back and forth. But there's, even with family, it's like that family member is going to pull you to the side. I'm really struggling with a house payment. Can you loan me $10,000 to pay off the house? And so it's that side of it too. It's not just the paparazzi, it's not just the public. There's times where in the family you have that that struggle, and then again, it's not just the white family, it's any family. And that's whether you're a doctor who's made millions or a banker or a Wall Street guy, your family still is there's that, I got to get a piece of what he got because I'm a relative, I deserve it. You said I'm entitled to it.
Yeah, not an easy one. And I, like I said, I feel like the concept of your show is pretty cool because you get to learn on the other side what's going on, not necessarily what the celebrity or the famous person's going through. How does it affect other people?
Yeah. Some of these people are not standing in their shadow, right? Their family member. I've had Jack Baldini from PodFest. I don't know if you, did you meet Jack?
No, I didn't.
He's like the attorney for PodFest.
Yeah.
His great uncle or think uncle is Enrique Caruso, the opera singer. Again, Jack's not in the shadow because it's, the timeline is different.
Right.
But he's got this connection. I just interviewed who I met, this guy at PodFest, Michael Osborne. He's the great grandson of Herman Melville, wrote Moby Dick. They're not standing in that shadow.
Right.
But they're that lineage. Okay. So knowing that you're part of that lineage, how does that affect your life? You're not standing in the shadow because people aren't coming and going, oh, you're Enrico Caruso.
Yeah.
But then it's there and you want to acknowledge it. You want to be a part of it. It's not, you don't lead every conversation. I don't lead every conversation like, hey, I'm Anna White's brother. And they definitely don't go, hey, I'm Herman Melville's great, great, great grandson. But at some point in a conversation, it might come up and it's okay. Takes it to a different level, whether you're in that shadow or not.
Yeah.
That makes sense. I'm saying, you know,
absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And now I remember Jack, he was the one doing the cigar under the stars night, right? Yeah. I think there's something you're touching on that I want to expand on. If you were to lead in with stating who your sister is, at the end of the day, what does that say about you and who are you as a person? If I were to meet you, I'm more interested in who you are at the end of the day and getting to know you as opposed to. And I'm sure the opposite happens too, right? And people are like wanting to know more about your sister. But I'm sure even for you, it's, no, I have my own identity and I'm my own person and I have my own life and purpose in life. But it takes a lot of work to get there yourself too, right? Especially if you're directly in that shadow. If you're not, still, right? I think we all need to, bringing it back full circle. And this was the topic of my talk at PodFest, finding that purpose in life, right? We all need to find our own. And when we're looking at someone else's and trying to emulate that or follow it, then it doesn't feel authentic and in alignment with who we are.
Yeah. I think there was a point, it's a twofold. When I was Where's Mine and Entitled, it was, yes, I'm Vanna White's brother. Mm-hmm. I know its importance. Mm-hmm. I've developed in my career, it's still important because she is who she is.
Yes.
I don't necessarily, it's not what I lead with. Sometimes conversations will come up and I go, mm-hmm. oh, by the way, that's my sister. Mm-hmm. Or Philip always laughs. He goes, no matter what Chip does, he's always Vanna White's brother. Mm. And it's true. And I think that's, it's okay. I can't change that. I don't want to change that. I'm sure it'd be different if I was as Jeffrey Dahmer's brother. It'd be a little different.
Yeah.
I've got this amazing sister. Mm. And sometimes it opens doors. It opens conversations. I don't throw it out in business, but if it comes up, I've had a conversation with someone before and I got in the door, but they're like keeping me outside the door, so to speak, not really interested in
right.
in talking about AV equipment. And then they go, I always say, my sister's taught more people the alphabet than every teacher in the United States. They're like, what are you talking about? Well, it's Vanna White and Wheel of Fortune. Then the conversation moves on. Oh, come sit in the office and let's talk. Mm-hmm. So it can be helpful.
Mm.
It can also be people like, and I'm sure that if I follow the comments when this is over, there's going to be a lot of make your own light. Don't ride her coattails. It's like, I am making my own light.
Mm-hmm.
Bottom line is she is who she is. And my mm-hmm. purpose might be to let people know that if you have a brother or sister, you're somehow in that shadow, whether you're the younger or the older. Someone, mm-hmm. one of them has done something that puts the other in the shadow.
Mm-hmm.
And there's always going to be that minute resentment on somebody, one of them side, like, you were dad's favorite or mom's favorite.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, I appreciate that additional insight. So what does the future look like for you? The show's doing well and you've got other projects on the go, but what does the future hold for you and how do you keep living your purpose?
I probably, God willing, got another good 10 years of healthy travel. We like to travel a lot.
Yeah.
I like to put in another 5 years probably of work with Philip at AVA.
Mm-hmm.
And I say that because we still do the podcast together, mm-hmm. very flexible. My goal is to do at least 300 episodes of the podcast. Mm-hmm. We're at probably 65 or so, maybe a little more because we got some in the can. We're shooting mm-hmm. some next month. So my goal is to do at least 300. I'd love to get one or two more sponsors. For me, I like having underwriting sponsorship. I don't like trying to sell ads mm-hmm. and this and that. It's like, this is your price. You get 25 episodes. You get the cold open, the cold close, and the mm-hmm. buy promotion in between.
Yes.
So I give you your value on your dollar. I feel like I do.
Yes.
Couple of those, like even with three, I'm not getting rich. Mm-hmm. I'm adding a nice little chunk to the family income where I could fix the driveway. But I'm not getting rich, and that's okay. Mm-hmm. This isn't to make billions or millions off the podcast. Maybe one day it might. I don't mm-hmm. know, but I don't mm-hmm. see that happening. But if mm-hmm. I can make a decent living at it, that's cool. Mm-hmm. It leads into speaking engagements. I've been able to speak at a couple recovery events mm-hmm. as a paid speaker. I've spoken at colleges as a paid speaker. So between filmmaking, recovery, podcasting, standing in the shadow, I have a lot of subjects that I can cover.
Yes.
Working in the corporate world over the years for public speaking, for paid speaking. So at least the stuff like that's great. I don't know. We got the ranch. We get us a cow.
Yep.
Try to get the land in good shape. Dude, I don't know. I just try to get up every morning.
Yeah.
Moan and groan as I get out of bed.
Yeah, that's fair. I appreciate all of that. Chip, thank you so much for this conversation. I appreciate your vulnerability and transparency around the journey you've been on and what it's taken to get to where you are today and what you continue to do for your recovery. I think that's the most important thing in my eyes. If we're focused on that recovery piece, like you said, everything else comes under that and everything just fits together perfectly. So appreciate all of that. Thank you so much for this conversation.
Oh man, my pleasure. Anytime. I look forward to overseeing the PodFest next year.
Maybe yes.
one or two of the other podcast conventions. I need to mm-hmm. look and see what's out there, but mm-hmm. I do love PodFest.
Yes.
And we'll chat soon.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you again.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for checking out this episode with Chip. As always, please subscribe to the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or YouTube. That's the best and easiest way to support this podcast. And on Apple and Spotify, you can leave up to a 5-star review. Please check out the sponsors in the description, as well as the Easy Reflections newsletter, a zero-cost newsletter that goes out weekly, where I explore different mental health topics and provide practical tips and insights for the reader. The link to the newsletter can also be found in the show note captions, where you can subscribe directly. Thank you again, and until next time.